Welcome to the Agile Wire, brought to you by Wisconsin Agility. We want you to get agile and stay agile. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Chad Beyer.
And we're recording. All right, kick us off, Jeff.
All right, we have Jim Benson on the podcast with us today. Jim, probably most famous for his personal Kanban book, but he's got a brand new book out that we're going to dive into. But before we get into that, we were talking with Jim in the green room right before we started here about he's coming out with a brand new like musical album. And I know Chad just geeking out, just you know, jumping around in his seat and he wants to jump into this. So Jim, tell us a little bit more about this album before we get into your new book here.
Well, so I've been doing music since I was old enough to make noise, I suppose, and hadn't recorded anything in years because I was traveling all the time, and it had taken me away from music. So at the beginning of COVID, I was thinking, hey, you know, if I'm going to like be in the house for like 6 months, I should probably get some instruments. And of course, COVID ended up being a lot longer than 6 months. So I had a lot of time to record. So I loaded up the house with guitars and keyboards and stuff and got together with a bunch of old people that I used to record with who are actual professional musicians and stepped through relearning how to make music through COVID. And so the album that's coming out, which will come out on the 1st of May, theoretically, I now have an ASCAP license, so we'll be on Spotify and Qobuz and Apple Music and everything else, but it's called Pleasure to Perform, and it is like all ex-punk rockers, I now do a lot of ambient music, so it's like half ambient and half what you might expect Jim Benson music to sound like, which is irreverent, sarcastic, techno-y thing. So about half of those two things. I would say that it's an album definitely looking for a theme. And then next album will have a theme.
That's awesome. That's exciting. I did something similar, I guess, over the pandemic, right? There was a lot of investment in musical things and even just the audio interface that I'm using right now for the podcast was something that I purchased. And I learned all about, like, you can buy really cheap microphones, but if you have a really nice audio interface, you can make them sound great and things like that. So,
strange enough, they're actually emulators.
Yeah,
you can take your crummy microphone and make it sound like any AKG or, you know, whatever. So,
if anything, right, I learned so much in the last several years because of some of those investments and purchases. Yeah. And then, of course, Jeff, you know, here made me start to post some of my parody Agile songs on YouTube and against all of my comfort zone that I, you know, I'm afraid of the internet in general and the permanence of it. So, but, you know, once now, you do a couple songs, then you just keep rolling with it. So, but that's awesome. I swear, like most of our guests we've been having on lately, there's all this new musical background that I'm learning about beyond just the, you know, the Agile books that everyone's writing. So very cool. All right. So hopefully everyone checks that out as well. But what about this book, new book?
Yeah, The Collaboration Equation. So why this is what, your fifth book, Jim? Like, I mean, you've written quite a few books.
Yeah.
So why one more? Like when you got four, like why go with the fifth?
Why go with the fifth? Yeah, because everyone knows that the quartet is where you're supposed to stop and mic drop and walk away. So a couple things about this book. The first thing was that this book started off being about 650 pages long. And my editor was relentless at getting it to the 300 and some pages that it is now. But for me, I started off wanting to be the Kurt Vonnegut of management. So the book was originally written just sarcasm from end to end, and he surgically removed most of it. So now it's actually a quite acceptable book that is two things. One is my history, my personal history with collaboration. Through music, through being a civil engineer, through software, through construction, through all of the interesting experiences that Tony Ann and I have had over the 15 years of being modus cooperandi since writing Personal Kanban. It's hard to believe it's been that long already, but sigh, it is. The book itself steps people through the equation, which is individuals in teams create value. And Agile's really good about talking about teams. Lean's really good about talking about value. And both of them are really good about lying about individuals. So I wanted to write a book that said, look, we need all of these parts before we're lean or we're agile or anything. What is the precursor, the prerequisite, the pre-work to having an agile or lean transformation? Because we've all seen them fail, and we all come up with all of these excuses of why they fail, but in the end, they're just excuses. If every one of them fails,
why are we doing it?
Then what?
Yeah.
So what I found, what I came to the realization of when I was working with Turner Construction in New York, was that there's something called a right environment, which is an environment in which professionals have what they need in order to do a professional job. Mm-hmm. And I was like, holy crap, this is why all these transformations fail, because we tell them to have a culture of continuous improvement, but they don't actually build one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the book.
Yeah. So you can use us as guinea pigs, because we just both read the book in preparation to have a chat about it. So mm-hmm. what I felt as a reader, and tell me if this was what you had in mind or if it's maybe just my experience, but what I felt as a reader was the beginning was a lot of system thinking, cultural structure content mm-hmm. that is extremely important and I get super excited about and, you know, prerequisite. And it got me really excited in the beginning of like the way you talk through everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
And focus on the collaboration and the individual, and like, because that's what makes teams, and teams make up organizations, and that's what we're all trying to move the bar on. And then it goes into the middle of the book felt very tactical to me, in that mm-hmm. all your stories and sharing your experience, even what you just mentioned, I think you refer to it as an acronym, REE, right?
Yeah.
Environment exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then coming out of the tactical, you end with this big kind of, again, I guess sort of this like change agent call to action around leadership mm-hmm. and how leadership has just the opportunities around leadership. So that's what I felt in the book, sort of this sandwich tactical in the middle with these, mm-hmm. with these end cap, large inspirational strategic discussions. So I really enjoyed it. The tactical for me was probably the part where I was, I guess in the work that we do, right? I guess I wasn't looking to just pull all of it and use it right away, but it feels like a really good reference section of the book. So what are your thoughts? Like, does that sound like something you were trying to hit as a target for a reader?
Yeah, so it was important to me up front, whether you were talking about my experiences or Kevin Chase at Turner or some of the other individuals that are mentioned, is that professionals are the things that go to work. And if we don't treat people professionally, which isn't like, you know, business-like, but like actual, they're human beings and they make decisions every day. And those decisions are only good or bad based on the information that those people have to work with. So in the beginning, getting an appreciation that individuals can actually go to work and have a good time, that you can feel protected at work, that you don't have to, that it's not dog eat dog. It's the off-leash park. You can go and you can run around and actually have a productive day without you know, ruining somebody else's life. Then as you get into the middle, when you get into kind of the teamsy area, it's like, okay, so what do we do with that? So as you probably got tired of reading, a common theme in that book is, I'm telling you the way that I've seen things done. Don't do this. Mm-hmm. So there's all of these patterns that you can follow to help build a right environment, to help build a culture of continuous improvement, to make sure that people are getting the right information at the right time, to make sure that people do the right work at the right time, to make sure that when you go to solve problems, you do it with the right people and not subject them to your solutioning. That there's a 1,000,000,000 ways to do that, but they fall into some pretty basic steps. You build up a bunch of options, you winnow those options down until you figure out what you're dealing with. Then when you figure out what you're dealing with, you ramp up the options again to figure out what experiments you're going to run to solve the problem, and then you move forward. That's all the right environment exercise is. It's just using people mm-hmm. in the middle. So what I'm hoping is that people will try those things once or twice, and then they'll figure out other things to do, because I've never done the same right environment exercise twice. Yeah. And at the end, the reason that the book ends that way is because I want it to be humans on either side. You know, so it's like a practicality sandwich where you've got two loaves of humans and then just freakishly practical crap in the middle.
Yep.
And so that you know that individuals cannot interact without processes and tools. So if anybody ever tells you individuals and interactions over processes and tools, it's because they don't understand what process or tools are or how individuals interact.
Yeah.
So that's what the end is it saying, look, we talk a lot about leadership, and in every company I go into, leadership means people who have been elevated to a certain position. And the book is saying leadership is a verb that anybody can act on at any time. Leadership is simply professionals acting professionally in an appropriate way at the appropriate time.
Yeah, I really like the way, I think at one point in the book, it says something like, collaboration can't happen without leadership. I had to stop and think about that for a second. Like, oh, that's really good. After I read that, like just that quick little sentence, like, I don't know that I've ever thought about it that way, but you really can't collaborate with a group of people unless everybody's kind of a leader and like, thinking about the greater good, the common goal, where we're going, what that type of stuff, right? How mm-hmm. do I make the team better, create this environment for everyone to be successful? And just, I don't know, maybe let's dive into that a little bit more. What did you mean by that statement? I guess I kind of gave you some thoughts.
So if we want to go music about it, we can go back and watch the 244 hours of Get Back. and you will find in Get Back that there are two types of leaders in the Beatles. And they're divided up between John and Paul and George and Ringo. And at different points and in different ways, every person in there, even Billy Preston, even George Martin, they all are exhibiting leadership in different ways to get people to calm down and do the right thing at the right time. And there's this beautiful part of Get Back where John and Paul are obviously trying their best to be buddies. They're like really, really trying, but they're not succeeding. And there's this one point where Ringo won't stop playing the drums. He just keeps playing the drums until they come back and start playing the guitars again, because if he doesn't, they're gonna have another breakdown. That's what I mean by that, is that regardless of pay grade or station or how many V's or C's you have in your title, no band, no group of people who get up and jam, no company, no team can participate if people sit out.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that part, that end part, obviously the leadership piece spoke to me the most too. I probably have been known to say something like along the lines of, I don't like to refer to somebody in a hierarchical organization as a leader by title, because I like to refer to people as a leader if they've earned it. Like mm-hmm. if I feel like they've demonstrated leadership qualities. And I think I've never said it the way you do in the book about like leadership as a verb. And there's even a quote you say, for capitalism to survive, leadership must no longer be a title. It must become a verb. And I 120% agree with that. Like just, it's so critical, right? And it's maybe not for it to survive, but I think there's so much money wasted inside of organizations because of how wasteful they are. mm-hmm. right? We spend money on things. And there's even a quote in the foreword, I think you talk about, the secret we discovered is don't talk about Fight Club. And I think what you're trying to, what the people who wrote the foreword are saying yep. is like change management. Well, if you're trying to manage the change, if you're trying to implement an agile transformation, quote unquote, you're focused on the thing and mm-hmm. you're not actually doing the transformational work by just rolling up your sleeves as professionals mm-hmm. and making change happen like by the minute in micro changes.
Yeah. Being agile should never be a goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Because the change is constant, right? Like improving inside of an organization, which means improving teams, improving processes, improving individuals. That's a never-ending task, right? So it should just be something that organizations strive to do, and not that it's always driven me crazy too. Like if you're chasing agile as a transformation or adoption, you're thinking mm-hmm. of it as an end state. Like we did it,
yeah,
and there is no end state.
That's right. Congratulations, you're now agile. Oh, really? It's like, it's now you're now old. Okay, good. Then I can stop being old now. No, I'm sorry. Cell division is not going to stop. So a couple of weeks ago, in our online community, Modus Institute, I do this thing called Weekly Gym, which is a running kind of video series. And in the last one, this company Wampler that makes guitar pedals, on their website, they had their 10 rules for jamming. And I took a look at those and I was like, damn, I wish I wrote that. So I did the next best thing, which is I co-opted it. And I took their 10 rules for jamming and I showed how that's necessary on teams. But their first rule is respect those who are standing with you. And that's such a powerful, like the word standing
yeah.
is so powerful because we don't, at work, we just don't have each other's backs. Mm-hmm. We're trying to like get our work done. We're trying to keep up. We're trying to go forward. And we see this every time. Like a team of devs will set up a Kanban and they'll have it all nice and WIP limited. And then there'll be this column with all of this crap in it. And then there's done. So it's like perfectly managed, bunch of crap, work's done. It's always testing. It's always QA. And if you tell the developers, stop coding, they will get mad at you. And if you tell them, do some testing, they'll get mad at you. And you're like, you are not respecting those who are standing with you. In fact, you're not even standing with them.
Yep.
You've taken your instruments and gone off to another room. And, you know, you're not a band. You're not in concert with each other. And I've seen that happen so many times. And hopefully now with ChatGPT, where the typist coders are being replaced by ChatGPT, that now we're actually realizing that the whole point of writing software is to solve problems. Maybe now we can have some better conversations about quality, about team members, about, you know, all those things that Kent Beck told us to talk about 30
yeah.
years ago.
Yeah, and I really like the analogy of the collaboration through playing with a band, right? Because you don't like go off and then you play over here on your own and then somebody else starts another song. Like, no, when you're going to play a song together, mm-hmm. you play a song together. Like, think about a song as like a product backlog item or a work item on your board, right? Like, mm-hmm. no, we're going to work on it together. It's kind of stressing single piece flow. Like,
yep.
we're working on this right now, then we'll move on to the next song, right?
And again, to go back to Get Back, one of the interesting things about that is it's the first thing they were working on, and it was the last thing that they perfected. They actually didn't perfect it until they were actually up delivering it on the rooftop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That all of the other songs that they did, they noodled around with them and they perfected them, but that was the only one through the whole thing where it was like the complex work.
Yeah.
And it was also the only one where they couldn't get John to stop making fun of the song. And we've all worked with that John on our team. It's like, dude, would you just shut up and shut up and code?
The one I kind of wanted to go back to is, you know, we mentioned this just a little earlier, like the basic problems mm-hmm. to the right environment. Like there's many of them, but I really like the way you phrased it, where you, because I had to think about these. I'm like, oh, I see these all the time. And I think just calling them out, I've got them written here. Teams tend to focus inward and become silos. We all see that, right? Mm-hmm. We get over-specialized. Specialty is the enemy of agility and probably even just solving problems in the world. Like the more specialized you are, mm-hmm. the more handoffs you're going to have. Teamwork tends to be designed for productivity and not completion. So it's like all we want is volume, volume, volume instead of like value. And we see mm-hmm. that all the time too, right? And then individuals and teams are given direction and directives that thwart rather than reward continuous improvement. So basically, we get in the way of ourselves for improving. That happens all the time. We need to be mm-hmm. very active, and so we don't have time to improve. I see that constantly. And then individuals can't act without confidence. And that's one that really made me think. I had never thought about that one before, but I'm like, we see this all the time. Like people, teams yep. don't feel the autonomy to like go ahead and solve a problem or to make a decision. And so what happens? They go from meeting to meeting to meeting to get permission. And by the time they get permission, it's not a problem anymore, or they got some workaround yep. or it doesn't matter. And it's like, we've wasted all this time. So yeah, those are four really good ones that you call out there in the book.
The notion of acting with confidence, when Kevin Chase first said that, and so for some context that doesn't quite make it into the book, because I couldn't figure out a way to make it not sound like it was pandering, but it's real, is so Kevin Chase at that time was a young guy in a company dominated by old guys. He was a young black guy in a company dominated by old white guys, and he was in charge of spending like literally billions of dollars in a short period of time. So there was no shortage of ways that he could get himself fired, right? And so when we set up an Obeya, the room that held all of the information about the project that he was working on, and in that Obeya there was a Kanban, and in that Kanban there were tickets that specifically had different stickers or other colors that you could ascribe to them that would make other parts of the company act. You know, mm-hmm. if we ran into yep. this failure state, this boss would react. This failure state, a different boss would react. This type of negotiation, a different person would react. And before that, every week, Kevin would have to go deliver a long kind of report to everybody and defend his actions. But with the room, everybody was able to see visually what he was doing in real time. They were able to stay calm. If they ever had questions, they could just go ask him questions about a surgical thing. Of course, they had huddles. Mm-hmm. And so when Kevin was meeting with the people from HR in this room and showing him how the room operated, they asked him, does this affect your quality of life? And he says, no, I'm in construction. We'll always work long hours. It will always be difficult. He said, but, and he said everything I just said. And he said, and that lets me act with confidence. And then I was standing like in a corner of the room trying desperately not to cry. And as someone who does what I do, you very rarely get a gift. And that was an amazing gift, because he showed that he got it, that the company got it, that it was working, but also just that the words he chose immediately said to me, oh crap, no one can act with confidence.
Yeah.
Like yep. global epidemic proportions, people cannot actually act. And we're wondering like why we have all of these social ills, and it's because we are all professionally frustrated and dissatisfied, and that does not have to be the case.
Yeah. So there's some other words that really spoke to me that I think dance around that idea of acting with confidence. so many books in our arena, right, use the word empowerment in the text.
Yep.
And you do, but you talk about it in a different way. And
nothing is more disempowering than the word empowerment.
Yeah, because like I don't remember who said it. I stole it once for a talk on stage, but something like fake empowerment, like you can't grant someone empowerment.
No.
Like controlling people think they can, but you can only take empowerment away from somebody. You have it by default.
Yeah. God damn it, I told you to have psychological safety.
Right?
Yeah,
exactly. That was the word I was thinking about. It's like psychological safety. There's the key word that everyone wants, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's talked about too, like so much now, right? Empowerment, psychological safety. And it's written on the wall and the values of the company are written on the plaque. So of course, that's our culture,
right?
The words
of the prophets are written on the subway walls.
Yeah, yes. There you go. There you go. We're just going to keep the music flowing here. So, but the other word that you use is agency. And I think you key in on agency way more, I think, tied into that confidence discussion than empowerment or anything else. So
because you have to build the system that creates that agency, psychological safety, empowerment, inclusion, all of those things are design elements in your social system of work. And Agile doesn't do that. Lean doesn't do that. No one's going to do this for you. You have to figure out what the people on your team and in your company need, and you're going to have to make sure that they get it. So one of the projects we worked with at Turner, they wanted a dog. They got a dog. There were reasons for wanting a dog, but they got a dog. So sometimes they might be weird. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be, can we just put documents in one place? Yeah. Can you not invite me to meetings on Slack? Lots of times it's just that. Can we please just not confuse ourselves with our day-to-day operations? But sometimes it's a dog.
Yeah, I think you refer to those as quick wins, right?
Yeah.
The things like that. Like, just don't invite me to these meetings or...
Or if you invite me to a meeting, invite me to a meeting through Google Calendar, but not through Slack.
Yeah.
And then, but you always want to put it that comma, idiot, dot, dot, dot. But then you realize that you do it to other people too, because there is no rule that you have established saying we won't do that anymore. So I
loved it. I think this was mostly in the beginning of the book where I keep referencing this.
Mm-hmm.
It always, the number of times that we say this phrase now on the podcast, Jeff, it's just going to get out of control. But Craig Larman, he's got his 5 laws of organizational behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And the 5th and final law is culture follows structure. And ever since I've read that, I can't unsee it. And I think even inspired by others, right? I think you quote Deming multiple
Deming
times.
And Conway's law is right behind that. Yeah.
But just the, I can't remember the quote on Deming, but basically, like a good system beats
a bad system will beat a good person every time.
Yes,
yeah,
because we're all mostly products of the environment and the constraints in the culture around us and society and the structures of our org.
Mm-hmm.
So we can wish for things to change. We can try to change hearts and minds, but it does key in that you have to start to tweak the structures and the things around us to really unlock agency and confidence and psychological safety.
So the one of the quotes, I'm quoting myself now, but from that 10 rules of jamming thing on Modus Institute is if you always bring the same tool, then you are the tool. To go back and do further music, you can take the Tears for Fears line, kick out the style, bring back the jam. there is a tendency for us to want other people to solve our problems for us. And that never works. Mm-hmm. So if you think of the 10 people you work with on your team as spouses, and all of this stuff is just marriage therapy, you would never read a book and expect it to fix your marriage just by saying, okay, now we're going to do this. You would have to have a conversation with spouse and say, how are we going to incorporate this into our own little buckets of baggage and weird?
Yeah.
And when we have 100 people or 100 different relationships between our 10 people, or 1,000, I guess it is, whatever it is, a lot of relationships between our 10 people, we got a lot of different baggage combinations there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Different triggers, you know, different tolerances for the unknown, different learning styles, different communication styles, different neurodiversity, different diets. Some people love baseball, some people hate baseball, you know. And so when you get into that, you have to figure out not just what needs to be communicated, but who's doing the communicating. And people are important, and they're not fungible. And at one point, somebody had the gall to like try and start an argument with me about whether or not you could do Scrum right. He's like, you know, there is a right way to do Scrum. And I'm like, really? And he said, yeah. I was like, so if you have a team of like 8 people on your Scrum team, which is perfect because it's 7 ± 2, magic numbers, the Kabbalah of Agile. And God knows I've never seen a team with more than 9 people on it. But if 4 of those people leave and 4 new people come in, even if they all have their CSMs, you have a different team and it's going to work differently. Regardless of how scrummy you are or how Kanban-y you are or how Six Sigma you are, how Prince 2 yep. you are, how safe you are, how daddy you are, how whatever it might be, there's 1,000 ways for people to get along and there's infinite ways for them not to.
Yeah.
And we have to find and it's a lot. So it's, people are like, you know, do you think Agile scales? I was like, sure. Sure, Agile scales. COVID scaled. Yeah. but what really scales is problems.
Yep.
Problems are what scales. And solutions have a half-life.
Yep.
Yep.
And so we need to recognize that you can't just be Agile. You can't just be lean. You can't just be Kanban. You have to be paying attention to the needs of the work, the team, and the people on the team.
Yeah.
And that's why it's continuous improvement, right? It's continuous. It does. There's a reason for that.
And that's right.
It's never done, like we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And software being done is like lawn being mowed.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing that really resonates with me when you bring up that whole focus on relationship and, you know, using it as like an example of just 2 people having a relationship versus an entire team, right? It's way more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why, right? The more people involved, right? The colder you get. Like if you're in a small farming community with 10 neighbors, you're probably pretty close to those 10 neighbors. But if you live in downtown New York City, right? We know this in society. You get a little bit you're more numb to
mm-hmm.
when bad things happen to people, I guess. I mean, it doesn't mean you're that cold, but it just, you're a number. And I really like tying in the way you also contrast, because we have to do this all the time as trainers. Contrast, especially with foreign languages, because sometimes it doesn't translate well. Accountability versus responsibility. And what I really got excited about when you're talking about the 2-person relationship versus the team is like, even in just the 2-person relationship, if you play the accountability game where you're holding someone else accountable for things all the time, that's not a healthy relationship. But if each person takes responsibility, that's a completely different way to behave.
You can't take responsibility without clarity.
Yeah.
Right. But you can always punish people for doing things that for failure demand, basically.
Yeah.
It is a painful and constant part of life in general. And, you know, when I had just left Colorado when the Columbine shootings happened, and people talked about that literally for 2 years nonstop. Now, school shootings happen and they're hardly even reported.
Right. Yep.
And because we have been desensitized on a lot of different levels to the plights of other people. And the reason that we had a really nice run of global economy was because so many governments were collaborating on a regular basis. They were, they had trade agreements, you know, they had all sorts of partnerships to build things and do research and whatnot. And about 6 years ago, that stuff started to, that collaborative energy was interrupted. We'll just say it that way. And since then, we have seen a lot of global fallout from the lack of global collaboration that we have. So this, these problems really do scale. And we need to work really hard on getting our teams and the people that we care about and the projects that we care about to work right, because those are going to become the microcosms for the way that we solve these much bigger problems that are looming right now, you know, fiscally, environmentally, socially, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to shift. I'm going to throw you like a two topic question and you can choose however you want to answer them, whether you divide it up. So, cause I was just thinking about our listeners and
it's going to
be a wide variety of people, right? There's going to be executives who have the decision-making authority to make some changes.
Yep.
There's going to be scrum masters. There's going to be all kinds of different titles, right?
People.
Project managers, agile leaders,
right.
Testers, coders. So I guess one argument I always hear in the work we're trying to do, because at the end of the day, the three of us and many people in the agile community, at the end of the day, we're a lot of change agents trying to just change things.
Yeah.
Pick your, you know,
trying
you went through all the frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, like, we can argue over the nuance, like, on the internet of all the agile community things. But at the end of the day, we're all sharing a pretty common purpose of, like, we want to make some change happen. And if you're a listener and you pick up a copy of the book, you're reading through it, you're like, man, I want to do some of this stuff. I want to make a lot of this change, right? I know a lot of times you hear the, but I don't have buy-in. So, two questions. I know that was really long-winded setup. Who did you envision your target audience for this book? And then if that person were struggling with that in their head of like, I just don't think I have buy-in in my organization, what would your nudge be to them to try to like make some change happen after reading this?
So that's an awesome and painful question. When I first gave the book to my editor, he's like, who is your target audience? And the response was humanity. And he's like, not good enough. And I'm like, it's going to have to do. So here's the thing. There's a book that was entirely written and has not seen the light of day that I wrote called Endeavor, where I contrasted and I have contrasted the difference between the word work and how that makes people feel and the word endeavor and how that makes people feel, because they're synonyms with entirely different meanings.
Sure.
Right. And so this isn't that different. So there's the drudge and there's the excitement. And what I see happen in all of the things that we do is we are so anxious to get to a solution that we skip steps. And when we skip steps, we skip human beings. And when we skip human beings, we create bottlenecks of information flow, of decision-making, of upskilling, of onboarding, of all of these different things, workflow, etc. Every time you skip a step in figuring out what work needs to be done, who needs to do it, and the best way to do that work, you will create bottlenecks. Information bottlenecks right now are our biggest problem. Nobody pays attention to them. Mm-hmm. But everyone is impacted by them. So in the book, I specifically tell stories about like Amanda and Savannah, who were entry-level people at Turner Construction, who ended up causing a great deal of change, you know, before they had even slightly matured as being part of the company, rank-wise. I talk about people in the middle. I talk about teams working together. I talk about music. I talk about software development. I talk about financial services. I talk about C-level people and super upper-level manager people. Charlie Whitney, who's in the book, he is a senior vice president and general manager, also at Turner. He oversees literally trillions of dollars worth of business. Yet he took time out of his day, much time, to make sure that an entry-level guy named Randy learned how to solve problems on a particular job site. That the act of leadership is something that we all share. The need for collaboration is something that we all share. And the desire to make work not suck is something that we all share. And depending on what our personal KPIs are or our personal pressures, we will have all sorts of bad reactions to those pressures that stop collaboration and stop people from getting along. So this book is literally for anyone who has ever thought that working might not suck. And that for the upper manager, the value prop of this is you can use this to build actual cultures of continuous improvement that don't waste your time and money on failure demand while they're trying to deal with bad process, bad rules, bad whatever. People will actually focus on getting the work done, which will give you faster product at a better quality. Mm-hmm. Entry-level people want this because you don't have to wait for permission to help out. The moment you walk in the door, you are a valued professional. Because you are a valued professional, not because we're making you feel heard or anything like that, not because we're empowering you, just because the system works. And then the people in between are those folks who are like desperately trying to figure out, how do we plan a project? How do we actually estimate? How do we actually negotiate with our customers? How do we make sure that we're building the right thing? That those middle managers who frequently are focused on making terrible productivity level KPIs can actually be focused on success criteria, like, is this a good product that people will buy, and then they actually buy it. So I'm afraid that Tom and you still get the dissatisfying answer of, this book is for every damn person on the planet Earth. And by the first week that this podcast's out, I expect to have sales commensurate to that.
Oh, that's a great answer. So the TLDR is humanity.
That's right. Yes.
That's great.
It's too long, don't rant.
Yeah. Awesome. That felt like a pretty good outro. Jeff, you're the transition guy.
Yeah, I think this is good. We got a lot of good stuff. Is there anything else you wanted to make sure we hit on, Jim, before we wrap it up?
Or plug?
Yeah. So, you know, if somebody was trying to get a hold of me or wanted to read more or learn more at modusinstitute.net. There's a free community that, and obviously anyone can join because it's free. And there's a couple thousand people on there right now that are doing nothing but talking about this kind of stuff. There's lots of agile people. There's lots of lean people. There's no bashing of these things going on, but there is a lot of straight talk about how we get our work done. The book can obviously be found on Amazon. And there are classes on Modus Institute as well, if you want to get those. But you can chat with me directly through DM once you're part of the Modus Institute community. So I am super, super accessible.
Awesome.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast. This was a great conversation. It's a lot of fun.
If you found value in today's episode, share this with a friend. Until next time, get agile and stay agile.